When I go back to read the ancient texts of the teachings of the Buddha, there's many things that inspire me, but one of the things that inspires me is how much that early tradition, India at that time, understood about the inner life, the whole mind, the heart, and in particular some of the dynamics that happen when people practice meditation, when people engage in a spiritual life. Is it loud enough, the volume? Okay. So, and some of this inspiring material is these lists that Buddhism is famous for. But how I understand these lists is that they're enumerating the ecology of the inner life, ecology of the mind and body. It's an ecosystem. And like an ecosystem outside, there's all these different pieces, all these different species and vegetation and weather and soil types, and all these things come together to make up the whole. You don't understand the ecology by just understanding one species in it and at the exclusion of everything else. You have to study the whole. And so when we study ourselves, we're studying the whole. And these lists are kind of, they're kind of like a wonderful description of this ecology and start understanding how these pieces operate together, either as hindrances, hindering things, or supportive for things. And that it is a kind of the emphasis is on conditionality, on conditions. And so all these conditions come into play for the overall whole. Oftentimes in human life, we focus sometimes too narrowly on a particular aspect of our experience, and we miss the whole. And one way to do that is to focus in some kind of exclusionary way on everything we think has to do with me, myself, and mine. So for some of us, me, myself, and mine is like the main character of the story of our life. And to some degree, it's reasonable, but it's also that to do it exclusively leaves out so much. And so to begin to open up, to become aware of the whole, the whole ecology of who we are, which is so much more than anything we can understand or name or identify as me, myself, and mine. And as we open up and start becoming aware of more and more what's here, and the awareness becomes more inclusive, which is part of the direction of mindfulness, to be more inclusive in some ways of the things that have been left out, we become better aware and wise about the things that undermine us, the things we do that don't serve us, the things that we do that limit us or hinder the freedom of the heart and the mind. And it might become as bad news to you to know that in order to become a wise person in Buddhism, you have to know how foolish you are. So not that any of you are foolish. But we have to maybe have other language, but we have to become wise about how we get caught in things and how we get reactive in ways that, again, undermine us or don't support us and don't support the harmony of the world that we live in. And it takes time to learn about that for ourselves. And there has to be sooner or later in any spiritual life, I believe, any spiritual life that anybody navigates, a serious meeting of what is not necessarily exemplary in ourselves. The things that are, that we're not proud of, or things that haven't served us, that are difficult in our inner life. the attachments, the clingings, the fears, the identity issues that we're tripping over and tying ourselves in knots in, all kinds of things that go on in there. And it isn't to be, we're not trying to kind of bulldoze our way through it, you know, to get to some great place. We want to take our time to know it. That's how we become wise. And as we do that, as we take the time and are the willingness to really see ourselves and face ourselves and breathe and get centered and be present, simultaneously, there develops these other qualities, these strengths. These strengths get stronger and stronger, and so one of the amazing things that can happen is that some of our problems, so-called problems, don't get resolved, don't get solved, but they become less and less important because we get stronger and stronger. It's kind of like what's a good example that am 3 years old and I go out in a really, really strong wind, I'm going to be pushed around and, you know, tumbled around, or maybe even hard to walk against it. It's going to maybe even dangerous for me. But to get to be a 170-pound old guy, I can withstand a lot of winds, you know, and to the degree to which maybe I've been working out and stronger and have muscles, I can do even better with a strong wind. I'm not pushed around by it so much. So as we develop these strengths, things that were troublesome before don't become so troublesome anymore. So the story that I like to tell is that of if a fly lands on an ant, it's a big deal for the ant, sitting on the back of the ant. But if the fly lands on an elephant, it's nothing for the elephant. Doesn't mean anything, just like, doesn't even notice it probably. So do you want to go through your life as an ant or like an elephant? In the sense that becoming strong enough, so a lot of the challenges don't really, in a healthy, very healthy way, don't impact us as much. So here I'm talking about conditionality again, creating a condition where it's easier for us to find our way through the life, rather than finding the solution, the cause, and fixing it, and keep looking and looking. If I just figure out what was going on here, understand it, then I can be somehow, I just have to understand it, and then we ruminate and ruminate and ruminate. And we're looking in the different, very different direction in that case than the direction of the Dharma practice, which is to look kind of within, not to find the true self, not to understand ourselves, but to develop this inner strength that supports us, so that when we do see what's difficult, we're not troubled by it, we're not swamped by it, overwhelmed by it. When we do see what's difficult about ourselves, we begin seeing where the attachments are, the clinging is, and we have the strength and the confidence to let go and relax. So in this retreat, we have these two different lists, two different pieces of the inner ecology. And the one that is undermining us, or hinders us, it's called the five hindrances, is the five hindrances. In Pali, the word also means coverings, rather than hindrance. And coverings means you can't see through them. They prevent us from being wise, prevent us from understanding really what's happening ourselves in the world. And so these things happen to us, that we have these forces that are hindering or covering for us. As we practice with them and see them, we are then beginning to strengthen potentialities we have, the faculties we have. And these faculties are called Indriya in Pali, and it's named after the god Indra, one of the ancient gods of India. So it's kind of like holding these up as a kind of like almost like a divinity within us. There's something very special and wonderful that's within us, something that is like that of a God. And so they're not like just boring little things that we have within potential, but they're something very significant that can have a tremendous impact on our life, these five faculties. And these faculties are things that are potentials that can become strengths. And one of the ways they become strong is just simply practicing, just doing practice. But if we know what they are and call on them and recognize them when they occur, there's more opportunities for them to grow and develop. And it can be a paradigm shift for some people about where they center their life. And one shift is that we center our life more in the strength, these strengths, than we do in the hindrances. So the first hindrance is, in our tradition around here, in most people in the modern world, except in the inside Vipassana world, call the first hindrance sensual desire. In the suttas, there's a second list of five hindrances that's actually more talked about there than that has the first one be acquisitiveness, just wanting things, to have things and have it for yourself. So they're a little bit different kind of forms of desire, but both of them can hinder. The second hindrance is ill will, hostility. They often say aversion in English, but it's, you know, to have a little hostility. Sloth and torpor, a kind of lethargy that's not tiredness, but the kind of lethargy and giving up and draining of energy, maybe because of resistance, maybe because of disappointment, discouragement, things aren't working out the way we want it, or the variety of reasons, but there's some kind of attachment there that gets in the way. And then there's restlessness and remorse, and people can have a lot, be very restless about all kinds of things, not even know why. And there can be a lot of remorse or regrets about what we've done and about things, and that we get caught in that, and they really cover over. And then there's doubt. And one of the things these cover over is our inner beauty. We have a tremendous beauty inside of us, goodness. And these get covered over by these hindrances. I think of the hindrances as reactive in nature. They belong to the world of reactivity. So wanting sensual desire, but some of it is biological, some of it's kind of seemingly natural enough, but it operates from a place where there's a stimuli of some sort, and then we kind of are pushed by that stimuli or react to that stimuli in such a way that we want sensual pleasure, we want sex, we want more food, we want pleasure, we want not to be uncomfortable, start fantasizing. On retreat, one of the reasons people will get lost in thought and fantasy is because it's pleasant. There's sensual pleasure in it. Sometimes the imagination kind of evokes all kinds of physical feelings even that are pleasant when we go into it. Sometimes these pleasant fantasies is an escape because it's, you know, sitting here and the knees hurt, the back hurt, the shoulders hurt, there's a headache and you're hungry and tired. And, you know, this is, like, you didn't sign up for this. So, you know, you've done it long enough. You sat here for an hour with two sittings which were difficult and you deserve a break. And so let's just go and give my mind free rein to have a fantasy, and it's so pleasant, and I'm very creative, so, you know, I'll just go to, you know. But it's kind of reactive. The faculties, which are faith, strength itself, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom, they are not reactive, they're emergent. They're something that arises or connected to something deeper in us. Something that we have, this wonderful part of who we are, this beautiful hearts, the inner goodness, is more of an emergent phenomena than a reactive one. It doesn't depend on things in the world, on senses. It doesn't depend on... it's not reacting to something. So like even if our mind has a thought and we react to it, then it's a reactive response. But these other things are kind of they live in us and they can get stronger, but they belong to a different level, different place within us. I think of them as deeper within us than the reactive emotions. Some people call them afflictive emotions because they hurt. They cause harm. And so that which is deeper than that, so the Buddha calls, or the Buddhist tradition calls the afflictive, the reactive emotions, responses, they call them unwholesome. So they don't nourish us. Unnourishing. They don't help to strengthen, develop what's good. But the Buddhist tradition, the Abhidhamma, these other qualities that are the emergent qualities, that which is deeper and not when it's not, you can find it when it's not covered over, they call them beautiful. They're just the beautiful states. Isn't that kind of beautiful? Lovely? That speaks about something within us. So we have this indriya, this things that are godlike, we have this things that are beautiful. There's a real appreciation in this tradition for something in us that's in our depths. That the hindrances cover over. They make it difficult to drop. They keep us distracted. They keep us agitated. They keep us preoccupied in such a way that we can't... Our ability to see deeply, feel deeply, is not there. So the first hindrance is sensual desire or acquisitiveness, preoccupation with wanting something. So I get the sense that sometimes, and especially here in Western Buddhism, that desire is sometimes treated like a four-letter word. That desire is considered kind of like not... If you're a Buddhist, you're not supposed to have any desires. Like desire... Like sometimes people even say that, you know, the Four Noble Truths is that life is suffering and the cause of suffering is desire. So you better stop desiring. That's not what they are about. The word is not desire in the Four Noble Truths. Desire in... There's a word in Pali for desire. But desire is the word itself is a kind of a neutral word. And it all depends on how desire is used. And what's interesting about desire overlaps in meaning with the first of the five faculties, which is faith or confidence. This idea of faith and confidence, whatever this sada means, shraddha, Sanskrit, is whatever it is, it's a kind of desire for something wholesome, desire for freedom, desire for goodness, desire for that which is beautiful, desire for things that are appropriate to desire, that are not because of attachments. And so Buddhism actually is a religion, a practice of desire. Without desire, you're not going to come here if there's no desire. You're not going to do this very serious, difficult work. It's not desire. There is an aspiration. There's a calling. There's a yearning. There's a desire. There's a recognition for a potential, a possibility that's wholesome, that's wonderful, brings about, you know, tremendous welfare and well-being to ourselves and hopefully to the world. And to desire that can be a healthy thing, but desires are also can be very unhealthy. There are desires that desires to harm people, desires to steal, desires to kill, desires to lie, desires to take sexual advantage of people, to all kinds of desires that is tremendously painful for this world. And probably many of you are living in the legacy of experiences you received because people's desires that somehow in relation to you was very difficult and painful. As I went for a walk today, I thought about, you know, all these formative experiences I had growing up of, you know, of other people's desires that, you know, caused a lasting impact on me, of acts of violence that were done, mostly things when I was a teenager, but, you know, but other, when I was younger too, of a five-year-old and experiencing sexual abuse from someone older, and 13-year-old and being pinned in an alley, in a back alley of, and, you know, I managed not to get beat up, but it was just a hair's breadth, you know, it's a hair away from, you know, getting pummeled, and all kinds of things happened, and humiliated, and taken advantage of, and lied to, and was, you know, all kinds of, you know, all kinds of lists, and I bet each of you could do that too, go through that, all that. And one of the great things to do, in Buddhist practice at least, is to recognize that even though we've suffered a lot, it's a noble, beautiful, fantastic thing to not be limited by that, not be hindered by that, but instead do the inner work to become a different person yourself, to become the person who would never do that to anyone, to become the person who has this strength, inner strength for kindness, for harmlessness, for compassion, for love, for generosity. It's a fantastic thing to do. And as we do that, this principle that we're not solving our problems, but rather we're developing ourselves like a snake that grows, and then when the old skin falls off because it's no longer needed. So it's a different way of approaching our suffering, our issues, our problems in life through Dharma practice that's a little bit different, or sometimes quite different, than the usual idea of solving them or looking out for the world to change the world, the other people, so that we can be happy. But to really find this emergent thing that can happen here within. And these hindrances come into play in our relationship to our suffering. They're kind of, sometimes they're strategies of avoiding our suffering or trying to deal with our suffering. So to suffer and to, well, you know, I wonder if they have chocolate here at IRC. I think I'll rummage around for it, and probably I can find chocolate, because that's what I need, because that's going to satisfy something. Or, you know, or become famous. If I only become famous, then I'll be happy ever after. If only I win the California lottery, I wonder, you know, I wonder if they'll let me sneak out here. I could get the latest lottery ticket whenever they come out, I don't know. So you know, sensual desire as a distraction, as a solution, as an overcoming. The issues of addiction in our society are huge. They're a form of sensual desire. And looking for pleasure to compensate for something. So that's one strategy. Another strategy is to be angry and blame and be hostile and avoid our suffering, because kind of be repelled sometimes by our suffering and our own suffering, and direct somehow out to other people. And it's like safer or easier to avoid our own by blaming someone else or be angry at other people. You know, a strategy that sometimes when I was younger I perfected was sloth and torpor. You know, I just kind of like go limp. You know, just kind of be depressed and just kind of bury myself in a book, or just kind of under the covers kind of thing, and hope that it goes away or something. Just, you know, just kind of give up. And then there's restlessness and regrets, and kind of, I've done that too, you know, running around and just ruminating, and you know, just kind of, you know, not being able to settle down, and just kind of just being overactive and not really connecting to what's going on, not really even knowing how to connect because the restlessness was so strong. And then doubt. They say doubt is the most dangerous of it all, because doubt is the one that is the most strong one too, that inhibits or stops our capacity for practicing, for doing something, to engaging. And that is what practice, Dharma practice is to do something. It is a doing. Even though it's very popular in the modern West for Buddhist teachers to champion not doing. I think because there's so much neurosis around doing, so it's a nice antidote. Just being, they say. But even the doing of being is a doing. It's better than a lot of the alternatives people are doing, better than the hindrances. But that is a desire to practice. And that is one of the things that we develop confidence in. We develop confidence in mindfulness, confidence in meditation, confidence in being ethical, confidence in kind speech, confidence in generosity. Oh, there's a whole kind of package of things that are called Buddhist practice. But starting thinking, this is worthwhile. I can give myself to this. This is valuable to do this. It's more valuable than falling back into the hindrances. I've done the hindrances long enough. And so there's confidence in the fact, also the very thing, this first faculty, is having confidence in all the faculties. Confidence, I have these. These are potentials in me. They live in me. And they're worthwhile tapping into. They're worthwhile recognizing and finding. Having confidence in confidence. Having confidence in strength. Having confidence in mindfulness. Having confidence in concentration, samadhi, being composed, being grounded, centered. Having confidence in wisdom. All in the support of practice. Practice I can do. Keep practicing. The other thing that we have confidence in is in the wholesome. There's a funny way, you know, it's a little bit strange logic, I suppose, but I think you'll go along with it because we don't think this way. But when people are caught up in the hindrances, in a certain way, something in the mind has confidence in that, believes that that is a way, that's useful, that's successful or something. And so what we're doing is we're beginning, so that's confidence in what's unwholesome. And what we're developing here is confidence in the wholesome, confidence in the good and the nourishing, that which is, leads to greater freedom. And what is most good and most wholesome in the Buddhist tradition is practice. Keep practicing. Show up for yourself. Show up in the present moment. Be mindful. And of all the things you can do in terms of practice, the most significant is mindfulness itself, is to be aware. To be aware, be present. And as the awareness gets stronger, it doesn't deny that we have hindrances, attachments, fears, concerns. But it's kind of like it's like a boat that's moored at the pier, and sailboat, you put up the sails, and it's but still tied to the pier. It doesn't go anywhere, no matter how much wind fills the sails. But if you untie the boat from the pier and it goes sailing through the water, it doesn't then stop because of the water if there's wind in the sail. As there's wind in our mindfulness, we don't have to stop for anything. We can just keep practicing mindfulness, going into everything, facing everything, being willing to meet all of who we are, the difficult, the beautiful, the wonderful. But we just keep going. Mindfulness is like the bow of a boat. It just, oh yes, this is true. This is what's happening. This is what's happening. This, it's like this now. It's like this. Oh yeah, this is happening now. This is, and just keep the boat going through the water, as opposed to, oh, my knee hurts. I don't know about this pulling. I think maybe, do I have cancer? Or, you know, probably it's gangrene. What's going on now? And, you know, I probably chose the wrong pants to sit with and meditate in because it's too tight. And, you know, that buying pants is like so difficult for me. And you know, where should I go? I wonder if Santa Cruz they have good. I wonder if the managers will go out buy pants for me. And that whole train of thought means that you just tied yourself to the pier. You just got caught in retrospective thinking, and the boat didn't keep going. It wasn't like, okay, here, it's like this, it's like this. And have confidence, learning to have, through experience, have confidence to keep going, keep going. Just be mindful here, show up. This now, this now, this now, this now. And slowly, slowly, with a lot of self-compassion, a lot of care and generosity with the difficulties of it all, we just keep going to have confidence in what's wholesome, confidence in the wholesomeness of mindfulness, confidence in honesty, which is another way of, I think I like to think that honesty is a synonym for mindfulness. We're just being, you know, it's just a way of being honest internally. Just that, you know, confidence in really naming what's going on, as opposed to being upset with it. So you say you have a, you know, say it just should accidentally happen. One of these days on the retreat, just kind of, you know, it was accidental. I was just like, not you to mean it. That you had a sensual desire. I mean, it does happen occasionally to people, right? It might happen. It might happen to you here. And so when it happens, you could say, oh my gosh, this is, I must be an embarrassment to Buddhism, and I better not tell them because they'll probably kick me out because I'm supposed to be completely enlightened already, and I'm just a lousy, no good, you know, meditator and probably a person. And I wonder if I should take up surfing. I am in Santa Cruz after all. And, you know, and so mind goes off, right? And so criticizes ourselves, thinks about doing something else, all these kind of ways, as opposed to, it's a sensual desire. And keeping it that simple. Sensual desire is happening. That's what it is. Without the need of adding the commentary, without the need of adding the retroactive thinking, the rumination about it, without the need to relate that to yourself, to me, myself, and mine. But then it might happen, you know, on a blue moon, that you something like you have sensual desire or something, and you'll think, oh, poor me, you know, this is hard, I'm a bad person. What do you do then? Oh, there's a, now right now there's thoughts of poor me. Right now I have a, this is a thought that I'm a lousy person. And as soon as you come back to that honesty, that simplicity, you're back on the boat going forward. You don't have to solve it. You don't have to justify it. You don't have to argue it, bring out all the lawyers to explain to yourself that, you know, actually, you, once upon a time you did a good thing and you should get a break. Just keep going. Keep going. So there's confidence in the practice. Confidence in doing what's wholesome, and that's supportive, that's freeing. Confidence in the capacity for liberation, of becoming free. It is possible to become free. It is possible to become free of suffering. It is possible to become free of attachments and clinging. It is possible. And it's the heart's wish. That's what I think our hearts most want. When Buddhism came to China, the Chinese had a huge challenge because Buddhism had been in India for about 600-700. It came for a while. It was brought to China over a period of about 400 years more. And the Chinese received all of the historical developments of Buddhism in India. And it was a lot of different schools of Buddhism, a lot of different texts. There was just so much for them to have to deal with. And it was a huge undertaking for the Chinese to make sense of it. And by the 6th century, there was a wonderful Chinese monk, I think his name was Fa Xian, who kind of managed to kind of synthesize, go through it all. And he wrote a big book about Buddhism based on all everything, making some kind of sense of it. And in the middle of that book is like the essence, he said. He summarized it all in one little sentence. He said, liberation welcomes us within everything. Liberation welcomes us within everything. That's a phenomenal statement. We mean everything. You mean everything? No, not that. Couldn't be that. No, that's not right. But there's a way in which when we're present, we can really present, we feel the work, the extra effort, the suffering, the strain of not being free, of clinging, of grasping, of holding on, of resisting. And when you're really present, you feel that no matter what you're with, what you're touching, what you're experiencing, if in you, if you're really being present for something, you'll feel that in that contact, in that meeting with things, that if there's any grasping, there's a desire for release. If you hold something in your hand really tight for a long time, just really grasp it, you'll feel in your wrist, in your hand, in your fingers, a desire to release. After a while, they want to let go. But if you're really afraid or really greedy, you maybe won't. And so your hands can go blue or get numb. But the desire of the hand is to go for release. The desire for the heart that's contracted is to open up. The desire for the mind that's kind of all constricted is to be free and untied. There's this desire for freedom to let go because it's hard to do the work of clinging. However, the hindrances, like sensual desire, they trick us. And it's part of their nature. They camouflage themselves. They camouflage the pain, the suffering, that how they limit us, especially something like sensual desire. Sensual desire has this tremendous allure of pleasure, of only have that, if only that'll do it. Or your pleasure is like, that'll be the antidote, that'll be where I get my relief. And we can get so pulled into this world of the hindrances that it's kind of like a black hole, you know, in the astronomy where the gravitational force is so full, so strong that no light comes out. Our attention goes into the black hole, into these hindrances, and we lose contact with reality almost. And so we want to learn how not to get sucked into that world. And how do we do that? By cultivating mindfulness the best we can. And that's one of the reasons why we are here. We're trying to create at IRC the conditions that allow us to begin seeing how active our mind is, how it's spinning, the preoccupations, the concerns it has, and to feel in ourselves that there is a possibility of relaxing, of letting go. Maybe you feel like your shoulders are tense, and maybe you can't relax them, but at least you feel there's a desire to release. Maybe you feel that you're really kind of spinning your same preoccupation, your thoughts over and over and over again. You can't put it down. But at the same time, you can feel there's a wish to put it down. Wouldn't it be nice to have the relief? Wouldn't it be nice to stop? That desire for freedom, that desire to stop spinning and be caught, can be a healthy desire to have. It can be unhealthy. There can be expectation, there can be demand, there can be all kinds of ways of having a desire which are not healthy. But the simple desire for freedom is one of the healthiest things we can have. The simple desire for this goodness, for this wholesomeness, for this openness, for the emergence of something really simple that's not so complicated. That has a better chance if we're building these strengths. If we become strong and be able to sit with some stability and strength in the middle of the hindrance storms. And all the hindrances could come, you know, there's multiple hindrance attacks that happen. And not just one at a time. And so to be able to not get caught by it. Sometimes the hindrances are like a pendulum. There's something called a vipassana romance. And that is when I'll give you my example of one of mine, when I sat a 3-month retreat. And there was this woman who seemed attractive. And 3 months is a long time for have a relationship with someone you don't talk to. So slowly over the 3 months, you know, I had ideas about her, ideas of talking with her, and it got to the point after a few months of, like, we were married, and, you know, it was a great relationship. And then we came to the end of the retreat, and they had, like, a circle where people could talk, and she spoke. And she had a very thick French accent. And as soon as I heard the accent, I realized I was living in a complete fantasy about who she was. I had no idea. She was completely different than what I thought. And so that was a 3-month Vipassana romance. It wasn't nonstop. It was, you know, it was intermittent. But so we get into these, you know, so it happens on these retreats sometimes that we have these strange things, you know, about other people. But then the pendulum swings, and then there's Vipassana vendettas, which it could also have nothing to do with the person. It's just like somehow the color of their socks was reminded you of like something that that person must be awful because, well, the socks prove it, right? And so then you make a whole fantasy to, you know, and then there's this feeling that you have this. So that can play out on these retreats a little bit. So the idea is to really understand and be clear and honest and present to see these movements of the mind and not be tricked by them. And that's what they do. They trick us. They camouflage ourselves. They have come with a sense of authority, of rightness, of trueness. Like, this is real. This is it. This is the woman. This is my enemy, you know, like I know. All kinds of things. And the idea is to, and sometimes you have to take care of yourself. Sometimes people are, you know, all kinds of things. But the idea is just stay in the center. Don't go on the swings for or against. Just stay present and recognize, oh, here's a romance, desires for romance, remind you, here is vendettas, here is aversion. Okay, I'm here not to follow that, not to follow the romance, not to follow the vendettas. I'm here to become stronger. I'm here to be more centered and upright and present for this world. I'm here to become the elephant if you follow the hindrances, you become the ant. Then you set yourself up for more reactivity, more of the same. But if you learn how not to give into that, but instead give yourself to mindfulness, being present, standing, metaphorically, standing tall, sitting tall, in the middle of it all, recognizing, knowing what's there. Staying in the boat, just staying in the boat. There's all these sirens, that's what can happen to Ulysses, right? The sirens that they called from the island. Don't get off on the islands. Keep going. Mindful now. And to keep going means stay in the current of the present moment. That's where you're going. And the present moment will leave you behind in a certain kind of funny way if you do this retroactive thinking. Mindfulness practice, we want to stay in the current of the present moment. That's all. That's all. It's not like hard work. You have to go. You can't go fast. You have to go at the exact speed of the present moment. And isn't that nice? So desire by itself, just the word, is not a problematic word. But we want to become clear about what desires are healthy and what desires are not. And what desires cover things over and limit us and trick us, fool us, take us away from the place that's centered, where it's wholesome, where it's beautiful inside. We want to recognize the unhealthy ones, and we want to recognize the healthy ones. The desire for the wholesome, the desire for liberation, the desire to practice, keep practicing, the desire for freedom, the desire to let our beautiful hearts shine unrestrictedly, to be open and present and available to meet this world. You all have beautiful hearts. There's this inner beauty. It's one of the principles of Buddhism. You have it in you. It's not a thing. You can't find it and hold on to it like a thing. It's something that emerges. It's a flow. It's kind of like closer to an action. It's more like something that moves. That it's emergent when it's not covered over. And what beauty in you wants to emerge if given a chance? Maybe we'll find out a little bit on this retreat. I hope that this practice here will show you where your confidence can be, what's worthy to be confident in, and where maybe in the past, where you're unconsciously you were confident, you realize, wait, that's not the place to be confident. The hindrances are not where to put your confidence in. The faculties are. So thank you. So a couple of things, announcements for those of here at IRC, is I've posted up now downstairs on the door going into the dining room, the right-hand door, the sign-up sheet for practice discussion. And there's the sign-up sheet is for 2 days, for Tuesday and Wednesday. Today's Monday, so Tuesday and Wednesday. And everyone gets one meeting, 15-minute meeting, over those 2 days. So you're only supposed to sign up once for those 2 days. for either Inez or me. The reason I'm emphasizing this is not always so clear. Some people will sign up for Inez and Gil, but it's only for one of us for those 2 days. And it's a little bit nicer for the people who are pretty new to practice to sign up Tuesday, so we see them early, and those people have been around a long time to sign up on Wednesday, if it works out that way. And then what happens is that you'll sign up for a time that works for you, and then for Thursday and Friday, we just kind of cross out and substitute Inez for Gil and Gil for Inez. So you have this. So you'll see both of us on the second. So if you did, whoever saw the first round, you'll see the other one the second round. And Marjolaine will be sitting in, and she's sitting in with me. Oh, it's over there. Oh, she's next door. she'll sit in with me tomorrow. And I'll say more about that tomorrow, but you're welcome to ask her not to be there. I'll talk about that and how that works. And so down there's a sign-up sheet, and one of the things too, this is for some of you, maybe a golden opportunity to watch the hindrances operate, about getting down there quickly enough to get there. to get, they're just the right thing. So there's that, and there's pens on the door handle. And then the other one is for those of you who are new to practice, new to retreats, newish, new to IRC, if you want to, at 7:15 this evening, well, I think Nance talked about it, we have this fireside chat. And we call it a fireside chat, but we don't have a fire. Because I think a fireside chat is kind of very kind of cozy, informal time to just hang out. And it's partly to help people who are new to, for a few minutes, break the trance of the retreat. Because, these silent retreats are kind of intense for new people. And everybody's walking around looking down. And so we try to kind of not take it so seriously. And so we kind of gather a little bit closer together. And maybe not as close as usual because of COVID, but just to be a little bit informal and friendly and just check in and see how you're doing. And it's a nice little gathering. So if you're new or newish, you're welcome to stay for that. And I think that's it for announcements. So thank you all so much for your practice, and especially on the first day where it's often difficult and challenging. But that's kind of part of the transition, and it's part of the kind of the preparation for what's coming, is to go through some of the challenges. So thank you.